Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us on the Narrow Path radio broadcast today. My name is Steve Gregg. I'm the host of the program Monday through Friday at this same time from about 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Pacific time. You may be living in another time zone. In fact, it may not be afternoon for you at all. I know we have people listening all over the world, and I'm glad to have you with us, although, of course, our international listeners don't call the program as often as our domestic U.S.-based listeners do, but anyone is invited. If you have a question about the Bible or a thought or disagreement about something you've heard me say, you're welcome to call the program. We have a toll-free number for those who are calling from within the United States, and we have other numbers that you can see at our website if you're in another country. Now, if you're listening from another country, it's because you've been to our website and probably are listening from there. So there are numbers there. If you are wanting to call from elsewhere than the United States, we'd be glad to talk to you in the coming hour. The number that's toll-free is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And we'll start by talking to Mike from Salem, Oregon today. Mike, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Well, thanks, Steve. Hey, I have a question. I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, though. I have a potential guitar student that wants to not be taught certain harmony and certain beats, certain melodies and so forth.
Because he's gone to Bill Gothard's seminars?
No, it's not Bill Gothard. Someone else, but it's like that. I never really experienced it before, so I was kind of curious what you knew about those sort of things, or have you encountered those sort of things in your ministry or whatever? So,
well, I've heard them from time to time. Of course, Bill Gothard's seminars have taught these things, and gazillions of people have gone to those seminars, and so there's other people who have similar ideas who are probably teaching them. That is the idea that, the melody of the song is, appeals to the spirit, and a harmony appeals to the soul, and the beat appeals to the flesh. This is, to my mind, there may be some legitimacy in that particular analysis, but then to jump from that to say, therefore, songs that have a beat are, fleshly, are sinful, is something that I simply can't really find any biblical basis for. I mean, the Bible itself says to praise God on the high-sounding cymbals and the percussion instruments and so forth. I don't know how you do that without keeping a beat, unless you do it without keeping a beat, which is kind of unthinkable. So I really think it's just a man-made doctrine, a man-made objection to certain kinds of music that people have found objectionable on another basis. Lots of Christians, of course, with the advent of the Beatles and the rock and roll revolution and so forth, did not at all like the spiritual direction that rock and roll music was taking the culture and the younger people. And so it would be very easy for them to begin to say, well, this is of the devil, this style of music, the beat, it just gets people into a frenzy and so forth. Now, I want to say that I think some music does just that. I think some music does, take people out of their minds, as it were, and into just totally a visceral, response. And obviously not only that, but the message of a lot of rock music is objectionable, although frankly the message of a lot of music that isn't rock music can be objectionable from a Christian point of view too. Christians just have to be careful that they're not letting the wrong messages get a hold of their head through the music, and also if they find that the driving beat of the music or something is having some kind of an effect on them that's spiritually negative, obviously Christians need to be aware of that. But I would certainly not agree with anyone who wanted to broad brush and say that you shouldn't listen to any music with a beat. Then, of course, you'd only be listening probably to classical music, and you couldn't even listen to Hooked on Classics because they had a beat to that.
Oh no!
But anyway, Michael, I don't really think there's any. I don't think that this teaching provides any basis for objecting to any particular style of music as a genre. Obviously, any objection I would have to any music would be if its message or anything else about it grated on my spirit and seemed to grieve the Holy Spirit. And I've never really had any sense that that this is the case with all rock music. And as you know, Mike, I used to play in Christian rock bands myself, so I might be expected to be sympathetic toward it. Although I don't like loud rock music anymore. I'm an old man. My nerves are frazzled. And, you know, I don't like to listen to a loud beat and stuff anymore. But I certainly have not come to the place where I would have to, where I would side with those who say, you know, that's an evil kind of music in itself.
Well, there were four areas which the video that I watched touched on. That one of them was lyrics, of course, and then melody, and then harmony, and then the beat. And then, you know, lyrics, I can understand that, but for the melody, I mean, he said that the melody, it's a language and it speaks to your spirit. And the harmony, of course, I mean, he talked about using diminished chords and how those chords were discontinent or whatever. And
so, minor chords are depressing.
Yeah, and so, and then harmony, and then it was the beat. So there was like a, there was the backbeat, which is the two and the four and the four count.
Uh-huh.
Progression. And also, so emphasizing those two beats, the two and the four, we should be, he said it should be more of a march. We should be marching like Christians, you know, so we, all our songs should like a march.
So did Jesus and his disciples march through Jerusalem? Is that what they did?
I don't know, but...
I mean, it seems to be that this person has more of a cultural objection. He probably would like to be in the Salvation Army instead of in a modern charismatic church.
I think so. But it was also the
although the Salvation Army also has a bass drum.
Yeah. Well, it's it was also the syncopation.
Which, oh yes.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know how you can get away from when you sing with some syncopation, anyways.
Yeah.
Sing, so, but anyway, I was kind of like, wow, that's just different. Yeah. I never really heard much about it before. I heard about Bill Gothard before, but never really about.
Well, that teaching may not have originated with Bill Gothard. As far as I know, it did, but he may have gotten it from somewhere else before him. But he certainly is famous for promoting it.
Well, it sounded like, too, if you had any kind of a soulful kind of a feel, you know, like a shuffle type beat, that was also bad.
Oh, yeah, anything that you might enjoy.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that was really it. I was just kind of curious your take. Obviously, it was sort of subjective.
Well, I remember David danced before the Lord.
Yeah.
And some of the Psalms actually urge us to dance to the Lord. Now, I don't know how in the world you're going to dance to music if it doesn't have any kind of a beat.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to do ballroom dancing, I suppose. Or maybe that's what David did. Maybe David grabbed one of the women in the crowd and just kind of did ballroom dancing down to the Lord.
I don't think so. But
I don't think so either. I got a feeling it was more Hebrew style of folk music, and that always has a beat. And it's in minor chords.
And he also made the assertion that the seven note scale was the seemed to be more the heavenly scale, and I thought, well, that was the Greeks invented that scale. That's not a scale that was common all over the world.
Yeah, I think Christians make themselves look silly when they come up with that kind of extra biblical stuff and try to sound authoritative.
Yeah. Well, I guess I probably can't teach the student, I suppose, but
that's too bad. But you can keep teaching guitar though.
That's okay.
Have you been teaching Sean the guitar?
Sean's playing drums, actually, so we're really in bad shape for sure. So
you're in bad shape of the family, yeah, that's right. All right, well, I like your family a lot. So
well, I appreciate that.
God bless you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. Mike, by the way, is the father of the young boy who calls. He's not so young anymore, but he still sounds pretty young on the phone. He's Sean, sometimes calls from Salem, and that's the son of Mike. And Mike and his wife were on staff at the Great Commission School for 5 years, running the running just about everything there for me back in McMinnville, Oregon. And he's a guitar teacher and one of the best guitar players I know. Great lead guitarist. Let's talk to Jose from Las Vegas, Nevada next. Hi, Jose. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, Steve. How you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, my question today is about the Babylon the Great.
Yes.
Who is she? I kind of have an idea who she is, but I'm not really sure.
Well, in Revelation 17, the harlot is said to be Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. And as far as who she is, this is one of the more difficult questions in the book of Revelation. And it really depends a lot on whether you're taking the book of Revelation as futuristic or past or pertaining to the whole of history. And these are different approaches that people take to Revelation. Each approach has its merits. But those who think that Revelation is about the future usually would say Babylon the Great is some corrupt religious system, perhaps the liberal churches, associated with the World Council of Churches. Some still would say that Babylon the Great is a reference to the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy or the papacy. And so that's how some people take it. Some people take it that Babylon the Great simply refers to the world system, but my own view of Revelation tends to see a lot of it as talking about things that have already been fulfilled in the past. And there are two main viewpoints about Mystery Babylon the Great that are held by people who are not futurists, or three. There are probably three main views. One is that the reformers all believed it was the Roman Catholic Church. And that was even held before the Reformation by some of the Roman Catholic people, for example, the Franciscan order and so forth in the Roman Catholic Church believed that the Antichrist and that Babylon were both images of the Roman Catholic papacy. That's one view that's been held. Another view, more common perhaps now, would be that it's Rome, because the woman is seen to sit on a beast that has seven heads, and the seven heads are seven hills or seven mountains. And Rome was known as the city that sits on seven hills, and so many take it to be a reference to Rome, and then some take it to be Jerusalem. And I don't have time to give you all the pros and cons for all these different views. I lean toward it being Jerusalem, first century Jerusalem. And that fits in general with my whole approach to the book of Revelation, which I can't take the time to justify here with my lines full, but you may not be aware, but I wrote a book that's been in print since 1997, and it's still available. You can't buy it from me because I don't sell anything, but you could buy it from Amazon.com. The book is called Revelation: Four Views, a Parallel Commentary.
Okay.
And it's strictly an even-handed comparison of four totally different approaches to Revelation.
Uh-huh.
I don't ever in the book say what my view is, although if someone wants to know what my view is, they can always listen to my lectures on the subject, which are free from my website. But in my own book, which is a big 500 and something page book, I survey the whole book of Revelation with four columns of commentary underneath each passage, comparing four different views. And I also spend about 40 pages at the beginning talking about the pros and cons of the different views. That's why there's so much on it. I can't really give it here in the format of a just a question on the air.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Revelation: Four Views.
Oh, Revelation: Four Views. Okay, I'll check it out. And about 144,000, what exactly do they do? Because the people who die for the gospel of Christ, those are going to be the ones reigning with Christ, right? So what exactly do the 144,000 do out there?
Yeah, Jose, it's difficult for me to answer questions about Revelation on the air because of the four different views that exist, and I'm not trying to promote my own particular view. The 144,000, but I do have a view. But the 144,000 are mentioned only twice in the Bible, and they're both in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14.
Mm-hmm.
And we are told about them that they are Jewish from the 12 tribes of Israel, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. We're told that they follow the Lamb, that's Christ, wherever he goes. So they are Christian Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also told in Revelation 14 that they are the first fruits of God's creatures, which would suggest they are the first harvest, the first ones that have come to Christ. And
be like Peter and
yes,
John?
Yes, the first Christian people were Jews. And I believe, James, in James chapter 1, is writing to, as he puts it, the 12 tribes who are scattered abroad. He's writing to Jewish people. it's clear that James is also writing in his epistle to Christian people, because he says, for example, in James 2:1, my brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. So he's writing to Jews, he says in James 1:1, the 12 tribes. He's writing to Christian Jews, he mentions in chapter 2, verse 1. And of course, he's speaking to Jews who were in his own generation. Now, he speaks to them in James 1:18, and he says, of his own will, he be brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Now, James said that the Jewish Christians of his day that he's writing to were the first fruits of God's creatures. And Revelation 14, I've got to turn there in order to tell you which verse number it is, but it's around verse 4. It is verse 4. Revelation 14:4 says that they are first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. So we see that the 144,000 apparently are the same group that James was writing to in the first century, the Jewish believers. And in Revelation 7, the 144,000 receive a mark on their forehead to be delivered from the judgments that are coming on Jerusalem, really. And when they receive this mark, it's a recollection of Ezekiel chapter 9. Because in Ezekiel chapter 9, when Jerusalem was about to be destroyed by the Babylonians, Ezekiel saw a vision in which the believing Jews, the faithful Jews, were marked with a mark on their forehead. And it was said that they were going to escape that judgment that was coming on Jerusalem because they were faithful. And I think that's what Revelation 7 is saying. Revelation, I think, is talking about a judgment that was coming on Jerusalem. And it is saying that God is marking, just like he did in Ezekiel's day, he's marking the faithful among the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah so that they will escape that horrible Holocaust that occurred in A.D. 70. And historically, that happened. Historically, the Christian Jews did escape from Jerusalem before the Romans came and slaughtered so many people and mm-hmm. destroyed the city. So I think Revelation is predicting that, and I believe it did come to pass.
Okay, well, regarding Babylon, who has killed more Christians than communism in the 20th century? Could that be a city on the 20th century?
Well, in the 20th century, you're right. Probably communism has probably killed more Christians than anybody
else. Millions in Russia, in China, everywhere, even to this day.
Yeah, that's true.
So that woman is drunk with the blood of the Christians.
Yeah, well, that's true. But over the centuries, though, even before communism.
So you can kind of keep that top-down look. Oftentimes, we'll tell parents,
heard
on Facebook, because there's some...
Well, I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. Was that coming from your side?
I don't know what happened.
I don't either. I don't know why. We were hearing somebody else talk.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. Anyway, that was very distracting. Now I forgot what I was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other people other than the communists have actually killed more Christians than the communists have, though the communists have certainly done their share. Yeah, the Roman Catholic Church actually over a period of about 1,000 years had occasion to kill a lot more people than the communists did over a history of less than 100 years. And some would set the number of martyrs that were killed by the Roman Catholic Church at something like 50 million. Now, I think that may be an exaggeration. I think that might even include casualties of wars between Protestants and Catholics and so forth. But I really don't know who's killed more. I don't know if the communists have killed more or the Catholics have or whatever. But certainly over the years, different groups have killed, lots of Christians. And you're right. Babylon is described as someone who's drunk with the blood of the martyrs. So it'd have to be someone who did that. Now, Jerusalem was the first persecutor of the Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Jerusalem is the one. Jesus said that Jerusalem had killed all the prophets from Abel, or he said the blood of all the prophets who have been slain from Abel to Zechariah would come upon Jerusalem. And he said that they tended to kill all their prophets, and they, of course, killed him. And he told them they were going to also pursue his disciples and kill them. And Jerusalem did kill Stephen, the first Christian martyr. And they pursued, they sent Paul out when he was Saul to do the same kind of thing abroad. And once he became a Christian, they sent out people to try to kill him. So in the early days of the church, when Revelation was written, it's very probable that Jerusalem would be viewed as the one that was drunk with the blood of the saints and martyrs.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, and I'll see if I can get the book, and God bless you, Steve.
Okay, Jose. That's, yeah, Revelation 4 Views by me, Steve Gregg.
Thanks.
Okay, Jose. Good talking to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, our next call comes from Gary in Seaside, California. Also, we have line open for you. Actually, a couple lines. So there was another caller who's gone now that's freed up a line. So we have line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Gary, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I want to take a bit of a an opposing view on the music issue.
Okay.
And and it's firsthand for me, having come back to the Lord in evangelical churches. One of the things that I noticed more than anything else that is that because of my background, and I think this is a big part of this conversation, is how this conversation relates to time and when you grew up and what kind of music you grew up listening to. And for myself, I basically left the Lord because of the influence of music to a great degree. And I went into the military when I was 18, and when I got to Europe, I in Germany especially, I was a big fan of heavy rock, you know, right away, and it was a combination of that and a drug experience that kind of I got very deeply involved in. For many years.
Okay.
And what I noticed within the context of evangelical Christianity is the rock bands that are worship teams. If I was, there was no conviction that penetrated the music, and I could never get. If I needed to repent of something, that was the last thing on my mind as soon as worship service was started and I started bouncing around to the music. So that in combination with a video series,
Hell's Bells.
Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll.
Okay. Uh huh.
I really appreciated the insights that video. Aligned me with that made me get the devil's music out of my house. And yeah, I believe it is the devil's music. For me, it's the devil's music because it relates to the devil's music. And there are some very physical things that happen to you when you are it becomes physical rather than mentally spiritual. And I think that happens rather quickly, and I think a lot of Christians just bounce from one Christian rock worship service to another, just trying to find the best band, you know.
Well, maybe they do, but let's say somebody was just really enamored with classical music, and they bounce from one classical concert to the next just to be entertained, and maybe even they picked what church they went to because the music they sang was more classical. Would that be a problem if they kind of idolized classical music and that got carried over into their attitudes toward
yeah,
worship?
Yeah, the likelihood is probably not as likely because of the drug Aleister Crowley part of it where it's do as thou wilt, and that was one of the you know, you don't find that too much in classical foray.
In fact, a lot of classical music was written for the glory of God. But actually, since the 70s, a lot of Christian rock music has been written for the glory of God. And
absolutely, I have a difficult time with that. I really do, because there was a lot of that music that I became very fond of. But what I found is that my Christian experience goes to new levels when I'm still and know that He's God, and that includes some of that music too, because you may not think so, but I believe that there's physiology happening here in endorphins and stuff that are pretty subtle. And
do you think endorphins are from the devil? Do you think endorphins are from the devil?
Of course not. I endorphins are not of the devil. I'm talking about the connection, and I'm talking about how it relates to people in this culture, in this age. And I really do believe that the devil is very happy to have his influence this deeply embedded in our churches, to where it actually keeps people in the physical rather than the spiritual.
Okay, yeah, let me say some things about that, because I agree with some of what you say. What I was talking to Mike about is whether rock music, or not even so much rock music, but it's music that has a beat or is syncopated in any way, whether that is, an illegitimate kind of music for Christians to listen to, as some people say. And they act as if the very presence of a beat in music makes it an entirely carnal experience for people listening to it. Well, I just don't see that as being biblical. And I hear you saying, and I could hear many other people say from our generation, because you are of my generation too, I hear you saying that, I had a bad experience with rock music. I used drugs. The music led me into, really carnal attitudes and things like that. And now when I go to church and hear the same kind of music, I find that it has the same kind of carnal effect on me. Now, I don't doubt a word of what you're saying. I think that's probably true. But it's possible that your personal experience has soured you to a certain type of music and made you conclude that the music is the problem. Now, I think the music is a medium through which the devil can reach people, and God can reach people too. Music is something that is, I believe, something God created, and the devil has learned to use it, just like alcohol or food or lots of other things are things God created. Even rocks God created, but probably, Cain may have used one to kill Abel. I don't know. But God made a lot of things for His own glory, and the devil has co-opted them, and they have been abused. And I think that music of all kinds is like that. And in our generation, rock music has particularly been used that way. But that doesn't mean that rock music is in itself something that only and always serves the devil's interests. It can serve God's interests, and to simply say the beat or the harmonies or the minor chords or whatever, or diminished chords, are somehow taboo for Christian music. I just can't agree with you, but I can agree with you about a number of things that you are reacting to, I think. And one of them is a lot of Christian worship bands and churches. I agree with you. When I go there, they don't bring conviction. I don't sense the presence of God. To me, it's entirely a distraction from worship, and so forth. That's not because it's contemporary in style. It's because of other factors. At least in my case, it is, because I can listen to other music that's contemporary in style, recorded music, and it definitely elevates my spirit into the presence of God. It's just that a lot of things I find when I listen to contemporary Christian bands who are leading worship is they look like they're performing rather than worshiping. They are so loud that I can't hear myself sing, or even the person standing on either side of me singing. I can't hear them sing. I used to like it back in the Jesus movement. The Jesus movement actually is what introduced contemporary music into Christian worship and evangelism. And yet, at Calvary Chapel, which is the beginning of the Jesus movement, most nights of the week, the music was sung a cappella. And you'd hear the voices, and there'd be harmonies and so forth, and it was very uplifting. But I can't deny that it was, had an appeal to the soul and not just the spirit. But I believe that music as a whole is an appeal to the soul. And it is a vehicle through which a message can come to the heart. And I think that a lot of the worship bands in the churches are not, helping people to really worship. Because they, some of the songs are pablum. There's just nothing meaty in them. There's no content to the songs. The music's too loud. That might as well be at a concert instead of at a worship service, because you can't tell. Even if you're singing it at the top of your voice, you can't tell if anyone's singing other than the ones whose voices are coming through the amplifiers. To me, it's just a bad experience all around. But it's not an indictment on a certain style of music. It's an indictment on the spirit of our age and the spirit of the churches and how they're going for an entertainment goal in order to keep the crowds. And that, to my mind, has brought deadness to the church. And I think that it may be possible for people to blame the musical style rather than perhaps the particular performance and selection of songs for the spiritual deadness that's involved.
It's the rate of conviction and that, at least in my own experience, and the degree to which I'm the impetus for conviction is actually allowed, and I know that that's a very personal thing, I would wonder, as it pertains to style, if we have, it's just like,
Well, Gary, I'll tell you what. In the early Jesus moment,
I used to drink liquor, it started off with not even liking liquor,
Okay. I've got a lot of calls, Gary, and I can't have the whole testimony, but I do need to say this, that you're not feeling conviction when you're hearing that music, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that a lot of times you're not going to. I do remember, though, in the Jesus moment, when the Jesus bands played, that I often felt conviction, and so did lots of other people. Lots of people repented and came to Christ because the music was straightforward gospel preaching music, and it had a beat in many cases, or it was strummed on a guitar, and it was contemporary. But it was not entertainment oriented at all.
Let me ask one question. Do you think that the music itself may have led to superficial synthetic conviction?
It could have in some cases.
That to me is where I found that I was living
sure.
inside the context of a lot of this music and
okay. Well, Gary, I'll take that as your testimony at face value. I'll accept that as what happened in your case.
Okay.
That's not what happened in my case. Now, it often does happen now with me when I go to a church and they're playing, when the worship band is supposedly leading worship, and many times I don't feel the presence of God at all in the whole church service. But that, again, it's not the style of music. In my opinion, because in my experience is different than yours. I've been brought very close to God on many occasions listening to music that was contemporary in style. But Gary, I've got other calls waiting. I have to get to.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for letting me voice my opinion.
All right, Gary. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Andrew from Beaverton, Oregon next. Andrew, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
How are you doing today?
I'm all right. Thanks.
All right. I wanted to go back over the Revelations, the four views on that.
Uh-huh.
You thought that it might have came to pass already, and
yeah,
that was
one view.
One of the things you were talking about.
Yeah, that's one of the views.
And one of those views, I'm just trying to put that together. I was thinking of maybe that could have been possible, but a lot of things in Revelation just don't fit with that, like... the 1,000-year reign, how would that fit into that?
Well, you're right. The thousand-year reign would not be something that is in the past in all likelihood, unless it is taken symbolically. The question was choosing between the different views of Revelation. It hinges a lot on the degree to which you're comfortable recognizing the visions in Revelation as symbolic rather than literal. I think our Western minds tend to want to read it as a literal description of something that's supposed to happen. And it may be that we should be more aware of the symbolism that is intended in it.
All right. Back in that day, do you think that they would try to confuse the people by making it that symbolic? Do you think that they would purposely try to go out and make people try to think about the Bible that hard? Or do you think that it was
right, possibly, yes,
made in
yes.
simple text?
Well, no. You see, would they make the people think about it hard? Yes, very much. The church was persecuted in those days by the Romans. And many people believe, and I am one of them, that the book of Revelation was written in a style which Jews and Christians would recognize, but which the pagan Romans would not understand. It's written kind of in code. But see, it wouldn't be as hard for the Christians and the Jews to understand it because they were familiar with those symbols. It's like if you were, if a person from another country came over to our country and they opened up a newspaper and they saw a cartoon there and there was a donkey and an elephant depicted doing something in that cartoon, and it was on the editorial page of the paper, he wouldn't be able to make sense of that at all, perhaps, unless he was familiar with American culture and American iconology. But you would know immediately, the donkey represents the Democratic Party and the elephant represents the Republican Party. You're familiar with that, but foreigners might not be. And so also the symbolism in the book of Revelation would be familiar to the Jews and the Christians because it's taken all right out of the Old Testament. But the pagan Romans had never read the Old Testament, didn't know it. And so many people believe that the book was specifically written in code so that the wrong eyes falling upon it would be not able to understand its message.
All right. So when, like, God wanted us to spread the word throughout the earth, spread his word throughout the earth, you don't think that somebody would interpret it so that we were able to understand it?
I'm not sure what you mean. I think we're supposed to spread the gospel, and I don't think it's written in code. I think it's written and preached quite plainly.
Well, like Revelation, when we're preaching Revelation throughout the earth, you think that people that don't know it symbolically because they didn't live in that day, that they would have interpreted it to modern day
language? Well, I don't know that God intended for any of the books of the Bible to be presented without any familiarity with the cultural milieu in them. For example, the Gospel of Matthew tells a lot of things that Jesus did, and then Matthew will give explanations of what the Jews' customs were. You know, because the Jews don't believe this, the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. The Jews, we have explanations for people from outside the area of the customs and so forth that would help them understand it, because the Bible was written to people originally in one culture. And then when the Bible is taken to people of other cultures, those who take it should be capable of explaining it, including, you know, the things that are difficult for a new culture to accept or understand. But we know that the book of Revelation was written in symbols. I mean, that's not even questionable. I mean, how is Jesus depicted in the book of Revelation? Do you remember?
As the morning star.
Well, that's one way. But he's more often, like 27 times, he's referred to as the Lamb.
Yeah.
And he's depicted as a slain lamb. Well, that's a symbol. Jesus isn't a lamb. He's a man. And, you know, and the devil is depicted as a dragon.
Try to understand it to the best of my ability. I'm just trying to see if it was supposed to be. I think some of it is supposed to be symbolic, but I think if we're taking all of it symbolically, that none of us are going to understand what it means, and that
not necessarily. I mean, people
be no point for it.
People who have understanding. Remember Revelation when it says the number of the beast is 666. It says he that has understanding, let him calculate the number. John, when he wrote that, understood that some people would not be able to understand it, but those who had understanding would be able to. And there are many people who have understanding of apocalyptic literature today who can give explanation of the symbols in the book of Revelation. It's not inaccessible information today.
Oh, so the Antichrist would have already came, and the I can start to see where how that makes sense.
Well, it depends
on one world religion, having the Roman Catholic Church be ahead of all other religions. It's the biggest church in the world, biggest religion in the world.
That's one view. I mean,
if that was
the historicist view.
If that was true, then they would have to be the new Babylon.
That is the way that the Reformers understood it. That's not necessarily my view, but that is one view.
Yeah.
Other people believe that the beast is Rome or is Nero or is Domitian or some emperor. There's a lot of different views, but that's why I wrote a book called Revelation 4 Views, because most people don't know that there's other views than the one they've read.
Yeah.
And it's good to know, because we're living 2,000 years after the book was written, and that means there's been 2,000 years that people have been trying to give explanations of it, and they haven't always given the same explanation. And so I'm just trying to familiarize my readers with the various ways that it has been interpreted. I'm not actually promoting one or the other, although I do hold one of the views.
So Revelation's Four Views is the name of it.
Uh huh.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to check it out. I mean...
Well, you can get it from Amazon.com or ChristianBook.com.
I mean, yeah, it's really hard book to understand. I just really want to understand it and the rest of the Bible to its complete context.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly recommend understanding the rest of the Bible before understanding Revelation. It was written last.
Yeah,
I know. It was written to people who already had access to what was written earlier.
That's true, but hearing it in the way that you've been saying it on the radio is something that I've never heard it that way. I mean, I have heard it that way, but I just didn't think it made any sense. Mm-hmm. And I keep hearing it. I heard it the other day, and I heard it today again. And you keep saying, you know, it might be that it has already came to pass.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to question it a little bit and see if it was...
Well, realize that John...
See symbolically, like, what the 1,000 years is and...
At the very beginning of the book of Revelation, John says that these are visions of things that must shortly come to pass, he said. And his readers were living in the first century, so he gave them the impression that the things he was writing about were going to be happening soon from their perspective. And so there are people who believe that that was quite correct. And that they
I mean, you can take it that way, but 1,000 years is also a day in the Lord's eyes, you know,
Well, see, right there, you're taking the 1,000 years symbolically. So you're admitting that there's symbols in there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, if the 1,000 years can be a day, and a day can be 1,000 years, then we have to be careful about imposing a literalness on it, don't we?
So a 1,000-year reign could only be a one-day reign.
No, I don't think so. But that's not how I understand it. But 1,000-year reign could simply refer to a very long time, whether it's literally 1,000 or not, because the word 1,000 is used lots of times in the Bible in a non-literal way. God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills.
Yeah.
You know, what about 1,001? Doesn't he have any more than 1,000 hills?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or that you know, a day to the Lord is like 1,000 years, or God keeps covenant to 1,000 generations, or a day in your presence is better than 1,000. I mean, the number 1,000 is used constantly in the Bible as simply a figure that means a very large number. It doesn't always have to be taken as a literal 1,000.
All right. Well, I'm definitely going to have to check out that book and get it.
Well, I'm not trying to sell the book, but I would say...
No, I know you're not trying to sell the book, but I want to see it in every possible way.
Sure.
I think that's the only way you're going to understand it at all, and being and having the Spirit lead you to what the truth is. But if I don't know every view of it, I'll never find out the complete truth on it. That's
probably true. I mean, of course, you could get the right view the first time without knowing the other views, but without checking out the other views, you never know if there's perhaps one that makes more biblical sense than whatever one you first heard. Yeah.
All right. Well... Cool.
Okay, Andrew.
Thanks for answering the questions, Steve.
Thank you for asking. God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye now. Let's talk next to Alan from Las Vegas, Nevada. Alan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having my call. I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate calling in and listen, not just calling in, because this will be my first time, but listening to all the people that do call in and just the encouragement and the enthusiasm that so many people like your last caller call with, just a heart of joy, you know.
Just wanting to learn the Word of God.
Yes. Yes, it's such a blessing. My question has to do with Christians and antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
And what would your views be concerning the way that Christians would go about medicating different illnesses in their lives, that way?
I'll tell you what I think. I believe that depression is unfortunately poorly defined. I mean, everybody gets depressed sometimes, but then they talk about clinical depression. And they talk about manic depressives, and there's all kinds of different ways that the word depression is used. And some of the ways, I think, are a bit inexact scientifically. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that a person who's feeling physically and emotionally depressed might have a physical condition. They may not have slept enough for a long time, in which case their brain chemistry is kind of confused. They may have a thyroid problem. They may have some other issues going on that make them feel physically depressed. They might just be exhausted. But on the other hand, there may be something else there. Sometimes people have depression because of self-pity. Sometimes people have depression because they've really got some hard burdens they're carrying. So I say, we need to be careful in defining what the condition is we're trying to treat and whether medicating it is the right answer to it and whether the medication is really doing something to cure it. You see, as far as I know, antidepressants, those who advocate them do not even claim that they heal anything. It's just a matter of treatment. It's a matter of managing a mood disorder. And so the first thing you'd want to know is, well, what's the cause of the mood disorder? Is it something that really needs medication? Or is it something that, can be endured and it'll pass? Is it something that you can overcome through, you know, spiritual means? And I think that more times than modern people are willing to admit, certain cases of depression are just something that we must either endure or can overcome through the Spirit of God and through the resources that God has given us. Now, as I said, there are people who have some medical conditions, or if it's not medical, at least physiological conditions that contribute to their depression. And if there is a true, you know, if there's truly a medical problem, then I could see why resorting to a medical solution would make sense. But I'm not aware of most people who are on antidepressants having really had anyone prove that they have a physiological problem. Some people just assume, well, it must be physiological because when I take this drug, I feel better, and therefore it must have been a chemical imbalance. Well, that doesn't necessarily prove that. Chemicals have effects on your brain. It doesn't mean that your brain was, you know, physiologically, you know, imbalanced before. It just means that if you take certain drugs, if you take uppers, you're going to feel up. If you drink alcohol, it'll have some effect on you. It might take you up or down. But the point is, it doesn't mean that just because the medication or the drug has a desirable effect on your mood, that your mood was caused by a deficiency in that drug or by a chemical imbalance in your brain. I think a lot of depression is a spiritual condition. I think it comes from, in many cases, lack of faith, lack of humility, lack of self-denial, self-pity, and things like that. But having said that, I don't want to make it sound like everybody who's feeling depressed is guilty of those things. But I do think that almost all people, myself included, do not walk in the Spirit as much as they should, and might find that if they did, that some of these problems would be minimized or eradicated. The Bible does indicate that the fruit of the Spirit is joy, And walking in the Spirit is supposed to produce the fruit of the Spirit. Now, the only reason that I would see for going to antidepressants, as I said, is if it could be shown that they are addressing some particular physiological ailment. I don't put medicines and chemicals in my body unless they are addressing some kind of physiological need that my body has. At least I'd prefer not to. And so that would be my position on antidepressants.
Okay.
I mean, it's no doubt the case that no matter what kind of depression you have, an antidepressant might make you feel better. But taking drugs to feel better is exactly what people do who are taking heroin and meth and cocaine, too. I mean, we have to ask, what is this drug doing for me? Is it just making me feel better? And is there a price tag that comes with it besides money? Are there side effects? Is there a dependency I'm developing? I mean, there's a lot to consider. I'm afraid too many people, Christians included, just go along with the suggestion their doctor makes. I think I'm going to give you a Valium or whatever. And they just decide to go with it because the doctor says it'll make them feel better. And I think if we have problems in our feeling, in our emotional lives, it can be a warning sign that there's something spiritual we need to attend to. And we can numb that with drugs unnecessarily and keep ourselves from actually doing business with God that we should do. It's like if a person doesn't have any nerve sensations, then they could put their finger in a fire and they don't feel it. And they'll burn their finger off, you know. But the pain that most of us feel when you put your finger in a fire is a warning system. Say, hey, something is wrong here. Something is being damaged in your body. And it hurts. That's why it hurts, because you're being damaged and you need to attend to it. You need to pull the finger out of that fire. And I believe that moods and, you know, being depressed and things like that can also be a warning system, an alert system that something is not as it should be in our spiritual lives. And the cure, in many cases, perhaps all, would be a spiritual remedy, getting things squared away the way they should be in your spiritual life. Now,
so why shouldn't I trust my doctor?
Well, let me ask you, why should you?
Well, I mean,
I'd like to know that
approach, every time you went into the doctor, you would just walk away from all doctors.
Well, I do walk away from all doctors most of the time, but
most people don't.
Yeah.
That's why
there's
a big healthcare debate.
Okay, well, I know that. And so let me just say this. If you want to trust your doctor, then trust him.
I'm telling you this.
Should
promote that we should trust him.
Well, who says we should trust him?
I mean, if I didn't know all about bones, but I let him set my daughter's arm because it was broken, I'd be foolish in your view.
Okay, well, no, let me tell you this. I believe I trust doctors to set bones correctly.
Well,
I don't trust doctors to make prescriptions on spiritual things and know what they're talking about. I also don't trust doctors to be experts on pharmacology. Most doctors give out pharmaceuticals because the pharmaceutical company tells them to do it. And many doctors don't know as much as they tell you about pharmacology. So, I mean, I trust people when they're dealing with their field of expertise and when they have nothing to gain by lying to me. So setting a bone, I think a doctor would be an expert at that. Taking out an appendix, I'd probably trust a doctor to do that too. But to tell me to put chemicals in my body to change my mood, I don't know that the doctor has any expertise on that subject at all. And so I'd want to find out before I trust him. That's just what I'm getting at. I don't mind trusting a doctor if he knows what he's talking about and if he's honest. But I'd have to know that when he gets into something that's really a spiritual issue. Anyway, we'll have to talk about that another time because we're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We're listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless.